Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, committed to a California where all low-income workers have the power to advance economically. Learn more at irvine.org. The California Endowment. Health happens when Californians value schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendowed.org. The California Healthcare Foundation, working to build a more effective, compassionate, and just healthcare system. On the web at chcf.org/health-equity.
From KVPR, you're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. Today on our show, young filmmakers address food insecurity in Kern County. And later, the Sequoia Parks Conservancy invites you to shift your gaze upwards as part of this weekend's Dark Sky Festival. But first, last week we debuted a new podcast from KVPR called Escape from Mammoth Pool, all about the dramatic rescues of hundreds of campers during the first weekend of the Creek Fire. In this week's installment, KVPR's Carrie Klein continues the story where we left off. As the flames closed in on the campground and the campers rushed to evacuate to the lake.
When you're in a situation where you think your life's going to end, everything's going to just slow down completely.
We like to think of time as a constant, as steady, unfluctuating, infallible. But in some situations, like if you think you're about to die, time can bend and flex.
It felt forever, but it was about 25 minutes.
It can even seem to stop.
It felt like forever.
It felt like an eternity. It just felt like eternity, you know?
I'm Carrie Klein, and this is Escape from Mammoth Pool by Valley Public Radio, the true story of how hundreds of campers at an isolated reservoir survived one of the fastest moving wildfires in California's recorded history. In last week's episode, we left our three families around lunchtime on September 5th, 2020. It was the Saturday of Labor Day weekend, and it was also the day the Creek Fire would catch everyone by surprise. At 10 a.m. that morning, it was just a blip on the radar, around 600 acres in size. But by dinner time, it had exploded to 45,000 acres. It devoured the 10 miles to Mammoth Pool in less than 24 hours. In briefings and interviews, fire officials would later call the blaze aggressive, unprecedented, and in a class by itself. With the fire closing in on the lake, these three families were navigating the throng of panic and chaos as they got ready to evacuate the campground. In this episode, the 10 minutes that took an eternity. When we last saw Carla Carcamo, she and her family had been watching flames tumble down the hillside. They were stalling, packing their trucks while counting the seconds until her siblings and cousins would return from a hike. They wondered how long they could wait. But as Carla made her way to her brother's tent to pack up his things, the decision was made for them.
All I heard was like a snap.
It was a tree coming down.
And then like a shh. And it just hit the floor. I ran. I have no idea how I ran that fast.
It was a crystallizing moment because as much as Carla ached for her brother and sister, other people had been accounted for. Carla's parents, young cousins, a disabled aunt. For their sakes, it was time to go.
We had to. We had to leave them because it was either you stay and you burn up or you go and you leave them.
They had heard that the road out of the mountains was blocked, and so the only way to go was further into the Sierra, toward the lake, to narrow, winding miles of dirt road that dead-end at the water. Carla white-knuckled the drive with her mother and aunt in her Chevy Silverado.
I don't remember if I was crying just because I wanted to not do that for my mom. But I do, me in my head, I just kept saying, the Lord is our shepherd. And I couldn't remember the whole prayer. All I kept saying is, the Lord is our shepherd. He will protect us. Nothing's going to happen to us. I said, God is great. God is with us. And I was just trying to, like, control my emotions, you know?
Across the campground, Alex Tedamonte was panicking. After she and her husband, Raul Reyes, made it back to their campsite to pack, she kept calm by helping buddies, a couple with a 9-month-old baby, a friend having trouble leaving his brand new DJ equipment behind. But once she and Raul were alone in their truck, Alex was floored.
She was having a moment, I guess.
Panic. Once we're in the car and we're going, I just let it all go. Yeah. I started screaming, crying. I just let it all go.
She and Raul had seen the flames over the road out of the mountains. So, like Carla, who had likely left earlier, they knew the only way out was toward the lake, a dirt road made more dangerous by the thick smoke. Under normal circumstances, the drive took about 10 minutes. But just after they took off, traffic came to a dead stop. Raul, who was driving, says they could have been there 30 seconds or 2 minutes or 10.
When you're in a situation where you think your life's going to end, everything's going to just slow down completely.
But he didn't want Alex to know he was worried.
And I was just trying to calm her down, like, it's going to be okay. As a matter of fact, I'm going to need you right now.
He gave Alex a task, call 911. It was one of the few calls that would make it through to the Madera County Sheriff's Office.
Once I had that task to do, I knew that, like, that was my job, that was my focus.
When the call connected, she was calm.
We're trying to leave the area. We're trapped. We have people running to the lake, like on foot, running to the lake as fast as they can because there's fire everywhere.
She laid out the situation.
There's just a lot of kids.
How many?
Families. We have over 30 families here.
Do you see flames from where you are right now?
In every direction, yes.
The dispatcher told Alex what they already knew, that the only safety would be at the water. But she stayed on the line, letting Alex talk and reminding her to breathe. Traffic began moving again, and as they wound their way through smoke and embers, Alex found another focus. She and Raul began to pick up passengers in their Dodge truck, hikers who were bursting out of trails or running along the road.
Hop on
if you need to, hop on.
Alex crawled onto the front center console and they crammed into the cab, piled into the truck bed and hung on to the open doors. All this as flames closed in. At one point, the truck even crawled over part of a tree that had fallen across the road.
How many people do you have in your car?
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11. I don't even know how many people are in the back of my truck.
Yeah, just get as many people as you can.
I'm sure this is against the law.
Against the law? Alex even cracked a joke. But she got tense again. She could feel the heat from the flames inside the truck. And suddenly, after 8 minutes, the call dropped out.
Oh, God. This whole thing's on fire.
Alex?
Meanwhile, Vicky Castro and her husband, Rolando Rosales, were also on the road. They, their two kids, and their niece and nephew were a few minutes ahead of Alex and Raul. But on their way to the lake, a car ahead of them suddenly just stopped. Its trailer had fallen off. Traffic was at a standstill, and the flames were moving in.
It was basically, you can turn left or right. When we turned right, the fire was about 10 feet to the left of us.
A family in another car ahead of them panicked. Vicky and Rolando saw them jump out and start running for the lake. With the fire on their tail, Vicky made a plan.
When I saw the fire, 4 cars behind us, I told the kids, get ready to run.
They'd run as a family, but when she opened the doors, her nephew panicked and just took off down the road. The other 3 kids bolted after him. Vicky was wrestling to save their terrified dog, a husky puppy named Loki.
But that's what took the longest, to try to get the dog out, and that's when I lost them, like, in 2 minutes.
By the time Vicky started running into the smoke with Loki in her arms, she couldn't see her kids anywhere. Rolando was still in the driver's seat, trying to maneuver their truck and trailer around the abandoned car. But there were too many obstacles for such a large vehicle. A steep slope on one side, trees and boulders on the other. He had to leave it all behind. Now, the whole family was running toward the lake, but separately. Vicky had no idea how far the water was, and she hadn't seen any cars make it past the gridlock.
I had given up. Just at that point, I was just standing there, and I'm like, I can't go to the front of me because it was basically smoke and fire. You could see, like, the flames kind of reaching out to the road.
But some vehicles did make it through, and out of the haze, a truck materialized. It was their friends Raul and Alex, and Rolando was there in the truck bed. They were reunited, but only the two of them.
I started panicking more because I still hadn't found the kids. And I was like, if I'm in a truck and I pass them, we're not going to have time to stop and pick them up.
Alex ordered Vicky to get in. So she did, handed Loki to Rolando and hung off of one of the open doors. Buffeted by heat and smoke, she shouted for the kids all the way to the lake. In the back, Rolando lost his grip on Loki.
Someone pulled our dog away from my husband, like yanked him out of his arms and said, like, basically, like, F your dog. And let his leash go. And our dog still tried to run behind the truck for like 2 minutes, but he couldn't. He got scared. And that's the last time we saw the dog.
By around 3 p.m., after harrowing drives, all these families made it to the lake, where scores of people were already congregating. Mercifully, the water levels were low, which left a wide swath of dry lake bed below the tree line for Carla and everyone else to park.
I have never been so happy to see that there's not enough water in there for it to be at full capacity. The water wasn't up high, and it looked kind of like a little beach area.
Once they emerged from the smoldering forest, cars eased down the boat launch onto the sand and inched as close to the water as they could. When Alex and Raul left their campsite, it was only the two of them and their dog in the truck. But when they reached the lake, around 17 people climbed out, reuniting with the friends and family who'd been waiting for them. Vicky and Rolando got out as fast as they could.
We didn't ask her to stop. Me and Rolando just jumped out of the truck and we're like, okay, now we need to look for the kids.
It was Rolando who spotted them first.
I can't explain what I felt at that moment.
Everybody was crying.
That was the happiest moment in my life, to be honest.
They'd find out later the four kids had caught rides with family friends. At the lake, they'd kept their eyes glued on the boat launch, hoping the next car to arrive would be carrying Vicky and Rolando. Everyone at the lake had escaped a campground going up in flames, and many began to feel glimmers of hope, even as the conditions worsened. The smoke choked out the sun, turning late afternoon to nighttime. From the inside of her truck, air conditioning blasting, Alex watched the fire make its final push toward the lake.
It was kind of light when we had first gotten there and we were like finding where to park. And then all of a sudden, like the sky went black. That's when it really felt like the true fire was coming through. You could feel and hear the wind whipping across the vehicle. You could hear and see the embers flying everywhere, hitting trucks and trailers and stuff like that that were all parked at the lake and just like exploding.
But she felt safe in her truck, away from the tree line. She began to wonder how long they'd be here and if they had enough food. Meanwhile, Carla couldn't sit still. She paced from car to car, checking in on relatives, keeping herself busy. If she stopped to think, she'd remember the hikers, including her brother and sister, still hadn't emerged from the flames.
Time passed by, I don't know, I want to say like an hour and a half, 2 hours. And every time more time passed by, it was like I lost more hope. I lost more hope of them coming.
But where Carla was losing steam, Vicky was gaining it. The six members of her family and dozens of others had taken refuge in the water. They'd waded in up to their waists, and she was shielding the kids from flying embers with a foam pad that she'd caught in the wind. The kids were in tears, crying that they were going to die. But Vicky despite the rumbling flames, their missing dog, and the terror in her children's eyes, she had faith that somewhere beyond the fire, there were people who cared, people who were doing everything they could to get them out.
And at that point, I was like, you know what? This is not where this ends. Like, we're not dying. That's not the way that all of us end up.
In the next episode, evacuees switch into rescue mode and heroes abound. That's next week on Escape from Mammoth Pool.
Subscribe to Escape from Mammoth Pool wherever you get your podcast, and you can find photos and more at kvpr.org. New episodes will be released on Fridays. You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. Why is food insecurity so common in Kern County? And what can people do to solve it? Those two questions are at the core of a new documentary called Invisible, The Unseen Faces of Hunger. The film was produced by members of Transitional Youth Mobilizing for Change, also known as Time for Change, a nonprofit that creates opportunities for young people to address issues in their community. I spoke with its executive director, Dixie King, along with two of the young filmmakers, Nicholas Holsey and Amaya. Dixie, I'll start with you. How did this project come about?
Well, we were fortunate enough in February of 2020 to have 9 AmeriCorps members attached to Time for Change. And we went through a month of training. Our youth got to meet with the AmeriCorps members, and they were talking about the kind of project they would want to take on for the next year. And the issue of food insecurity came up. And within a week of our AmeriCorps members coming on full time after their training, we were shut down by COVID-19. And all of a sudden, food insecurity became not just an issue for certain people out in the community that are often stereotyped as homeless or choosing to not work or chronically dealing with addiction or whatever it might be. And COVID-19 made food insecurity part of the lives of a lot of people who never anticipated that they would ever be in a food distribution line. So the topic became an important one to us, and our AmeriCorps members were frontline workers, so they were out on food distribution lines, and we took advantage of that because there were so many people sitting in line for hours, and we started conducting surveys, and we conducted surveys all over the county, from Ridgecrest to Delano to Fraser Park to Maricopa, and in many locations in Bakersfield. And as part of that, we were asking people about their experience of food insecurity, and that was when the idea of a documentary really was born. And that's when we started asking people if they would be willing to be interviewed, and started moving in the direction of doing a documentary, which I might add, we thought would be about 7 or 8 minutes long and ended up being 40 minutes long because there was just so much to address. And I think the passion was really about removing stereotypes and stigma from the issue of food insecurity.
Nick, I'd like to turn to you. The people that you talk to in this film are so candid and so open about their struggles with food insecurity. Given the stigma around asking for assistance, was it difficult to find people who were willing to open up and share their story?
You know, it really wasn't difficult at all, I don't feel, to find people that were willing to talk about their story. People want to be heard, and people want to reduce the stigma of food insecurity. Because the truth is there are so many people in America that are simply one check away from being food insecure. And so everyone knows that this is a conversation that we need to have. We just needed to have people that were brave enough to say what's really going on right now. And those people were so excited to do so.
Amaya, you narrate the film, and I understand that this is a topic that's personal for you.
I grew up in a part of Bakersfield that is considered a food desert. Our nearest grocery store was down the road by quite a few miles, and the closest place that we had was a little liquor store that sold canned food.
So it's something that I'm familiar with, and it's something that is both personal to me, but something that I wouldn't wish upon anyone else. Like, it was really rough growing up because it was a lot easier and a lot cheaper to just get fast food or junk food, because we could get a lot of that for the price of vegetables, for example. So we grew up with a lot of like junk food, and that was just what was available to us. We didn't really have too much to choose from. And eventually when we did start going to a grocery store, it was pretty much across town from us. We had to drive into the Rosedale area, which was quite a distance for us actually, but it was something that I wasn't aware of at the time. Because when you're a kid, you don't realize there's a world outside of you. It seemed like, oh, everybody does this, or oh, everybody's having to deal with this. But it was eye-opening to realize that this isn't the norm, I guess, in Bakersfield. Like, most people, in my experience at least, most people do have access to grocery stores and all sorts of things like that. But it wasn't something that I was aware of until I was almost an adult at that point.
Can you say more about what you learned as a result of working on this project?
I guess one of the biggest takeaways from this project, for me at least, was that there are options out there. I didn't know what a food line was until I heard about it through this project. It wasn't something that I was even remotely familiar with. It was both scary and like a huge relief to know that there are resources out there, because it was kind of like, well, where was all this when I was a kid? I wish I had known so that we could have been doing a little better for ourselves. But at the same time, I'm glad to know that there are resources out there. I'm really glad that there are people out there making things even a little bit easier for other people who are experiencing food insecurity.
Dissy, can you talk a bit about what you hope to accomplish with this film and how it aligns with the objectives of Transitional Youth Mobilizing for Change?
I think this film ended up being as much a surprise to me as it probably did to the youth who were working on it. We knew that we were talking about an important topic. I don't think any of us understood the implications of food deserts, of what food insecurity looks like for real people, or the sheer numbers of people who are impacted from so many different walks of life, whether we're talking about seniors on fixed incomes, or we're talking about families that are dealing with COVID and have lost their jobs, or they're laid off for a period of time, or we're talking about people who are coming out of incarceration and no one's willing to hire them because of their backgrounds, or we're talking about people who are coming out of recovery. There are just so many different people who are impacted by food insecurity, and it's not about fault or blame or not trying to do something. So I think in the end, we ended up hoping that this film would capture people's imaginations, that it would decrease stigma and judgment toward people who do experience food insecurity, that it would wake people up to the fact that we all have a role that we can play, whether that's through planting a garden or donating food out of our pantry that is extra that we don't need, or whether it's voting to get certain kinds of policy changes made. For example, the universal free school lunch program was something that is advocated for in our film. And beautifully enough, California became the first state in the nation in June to actually have written into the budget and passed universal free lunch at school. Why is that important? I mean, kids who were not able to bring their own lunch, didn't have access to food at home, could always come and get free and reduced lunch at school, but it stigmatized them. And so a lot of kids, particularly by the time they got to high school level, refused to go into those lines or get food, even though they needed it desperately. So I think we wanted to raise consciousness, and I think we wanted to decrease stigma. And what came of it was just watching this remarkable teamwork come together for our youth who really put a lot of time and effort into this. I can't even express how much time and effort. It was one thing for our AmeriCorps members to be out collecting surveys. There were a lot of tears during that survey collection period because of the stories that we were hearing from people. And we watched people turned away because there wasn't enough food during the early days of COVID. And we watched people hysterically trying to figure out how they were going to feed their kids. And it really impacted us. But I think as time went on, as our youth started time stamping their material, as they started reaching out to more people to conduct interviews, as they started going out and collecting B-roll and all of these things, we're not a filmmaking organization. This was something that we decided to do because it was such a passionate topic for us. And we did have some people who had been through some video production training as part of their high school careers. We had one young woman who works on our staff who did have a background in television in Mexico. So she brought a little bit of her expertise. She and Nick were our film editors. They put in incredible amount of time. Two people who are more different, you could not anticipate meeting, and they became such friends, I think, and colleagues over this. And just watching our youth become passionate about the topic, and most importantly, our youth beginning to understand that they can make a difference, that they can take a topic like food insecurity and they can raise awareness about it, that they can actually have an impact on their community. That is part of our mission at Time for Change, as we like to call it. Transitional Youth Mobilizing for Change, TYM, Time for Change. And the fact that young people can make a difference is not only empowering, I think it's essential, because I think too many of us grow up thinking that we don't have the ability to make positive change, or why bother because we're only one person. But our young people learned that just a small handful of people can make a huge difference in the world. And that's exactly what we wanted to accomplish.
Nicholas, can you talk about what this process was like for you and what you learned and how you grew as a result of working on this film?
I grew in a lot of ways. I grew in an understanding that I had yet to experience, you know, seeing and hearing some of the stories really blew my mind because it wasn't something I had seen in my own perspective and my own walk in life. And so it opened my eyes to some of the struggles and of which I had not known before. And that was a really big part. And also I think I was able to grow as a filmmaker, you know, getting the opportunity to not only, you know, take on such a big film, but take on something that meant a lot to a lot of people, really helped to make sure that I felt accountable on the film, which helped me get more creative, which created a lot of cool opportunities for better shots and higher quality editing. And the love and the passion for the project is what drove the creativity on it.
So Dixie, for people who are listening and want to watch the film, how can they see it?
They can go to YouTube and they can type in Invisible and then colon, the Unseen Faces of Hunger in Kern. And they can also get a link through our website at timeforchange.org, T-Y-M numeral 4, change.org. We have been accepted into a film festival, and we have others that we've applied to. So we're excited to see where this film takes us. And our youth are already planning their next adventure into filmmaking and documentary filmmaking specifically.
Well, I've been talking with Dixie King, Executive Director of Transitional Youth Mobilizing for Change, and filmmakers Amaya and Nicholas Holsey. Thank you all so much for being on the show.
Yeah, thank you so much. This was an incredible opportunity.
Thank you. We really appreciate your time.
This is Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. For 40 years, Heinz Hospice has been working to comfort terminally ill patients and help their loved ones say goodbye. But their counseling services are available to anyone in the community in need of grief support, services that are proving to be particularly vital as we move through the pandemic. To learn more, I spoke with Kathy Cromwell, Heinz Hospice Executive Director of Counseling and Support Services. How has the pandemic impacted the work that you do?
I would say that we have seen our work impacted by the pandemic in a variety of ways. as it relates to those clients that we're serving that are grieving the loss of a loved one, the pandemic has really impacted, one, just the rituals around loss, whether that be memorial services, family gatherings, specific faith traditions that haven't been able to take place because of the pandemic and the restrictions of gathering. That really impacts that experience for loved ones who are grieving. And when we think about one of the things that occurs as we come together in these rituals is the shared community and that shared sense of support. So grievers have certainly been more isolated in that grief experience. I would say another thing that's really occurred in the pandemic that we saw is people reaching out for grief support. And for some of them, it might have been a couple of years since the loss. And they found that with more time isolated, that they were having more of an emotional response to the loss. So some people shared, you know, I slowed down and I'm really feeling the feelings of this loss. And I don't understand this because the loss occurred 2 years ago. And why am I feeling this now? Of course, we know that grief is unending. It certainly changes over the course. But I think what we saw is people were feeling things in that slowing down. And then also related to the grief of the experiences that were in the present that impacted that loss for them.
Obviously, people really struggle to talk about death and dying. It's not something that we as a culture are particularly well equipped to handle. I would love to hear your thoughts about what we all stand to gain by building our capacity to talk about death and dying.
Absolutely. And you are so accurate in that description of how we look at that as in our society and don't have the conversations. I teach a course, Kathleen, actually at Fresno State called Death and Dying. It's an elective undergraduate course in the social work gerontology department at Fresno State. And the students will even share how when they tell others about this class that they're taking called Death and Dying, the responses that they get in just sharing that they're going to be taking a class that talks about death and dying and end of life. And one of the things that I share with the students on the first night of class that I truly believe in 20 plus years of working in hospice as well, that when we learn about dying, I think we also learn about living. And as hard as the subject can be, and I do understand that, the feelings that come up for people, you know, thinking about losing a loved one or their own deaths, you know, we have an emotional response to that. We all have our own story of our losses in our life. And so I certainly validate that. But at the same time, when we have these discussions, it can really impact end of life in a different way. And so what I mean about that is families can talk about maybe some things that are unresolved or planning for funeral or what are their end of life wishes, because that's so important for families to know, because sometimes those wishes haven't been known and family members might have a different interpretation of what their loved one would have wanted. And that's really difficult to sort out as you're also emotionally in this time of saying goodbye or have just lost a loved one.
Earlier, you were talking about how the pandemic has forced some of us to reflect and intensified some feelings. And certainly this has just been an incredibly challenging year and a half for so many people. And then on top of that, the news just in the last couple of weeks has been incredibly difficult. You know, we've seen so many lives lost, you know, between the rise in COVID cases and Hurricane Ida and Afghanistan, and then all of that happening as we approach the anniversary of 9/11. It's just collectively a lot. And I'm sure that it's left a lot of people with a sense of anxiety or depression. What advice do you have for how to manage periods like this when the news is so heavy and potentially triggering?
Yeah, that's a great question, because I think currently we can all really relate to that, and especially as we see, you know, visual examples of the pain and the loss and the layers of that. Again, we have our own experiences and our perceptions and our grief related to these losses. And so I think, you know, what I would say is, one, allow yourself to honor those feelings for you. And so what I mean by that is sometimes we will, you know, minimize, maybe we have an emotional reaction to watching an event that you shared about, Kathleen, and then we'll say, well, gosh, why am I getting so upset? Because there's people, you know, that are, you know, have it worse or experiencing this firsthand. And so we sometimes even shame ourselves about our emotional reactions. So I always encourage to allow our feelings and allow those emotions and to process them. And so that might be processing them with a friend or journaling and just allowing a space for them without judgment and self-criticism.
You know, I'm curious, how has your work with people facing life-limiting illnesses, as well as, you know, people who have lost loved ones, shaped your approach to living?
I guess, you know, I would say there's an increased sensitivity to just not knowing what people are going through and just having an awareness, I guess, of that, that often when you encounter someone, you really don't know what is happening in their life. And many times in grief and loss, we may not share that, what that experience is and what we're currently going through. I would say, in addition to that, working with those at the end of their life has just really taught me about the importance of conversations and communication and just how helpful that can be in a relationship end of life and in the journey of grief. You know, when I think of myself, I was a young 26-year-old when my father was a hospice patient. And I still can vividly remember him starting a particular conversation with me. And looking back, Kathleen, I wish we could have had this conversation. Yet the feelings that came up for me when he began to share, I shut it down really quick because I just wasn't sure how to maneuver it and manage those feelings. And I don't beat myself up about that because I just, you know, I know that I was having that emotional response. Yet 20 years later in doing this work, I think, wow, I wish I could have let my dad continue to communicate what he was trying to say to me before shutting it down. And so, you know, did some work in that in journaling and just, you know, within in my heart to have that conversation with my dad. But I think what happens is so often the emotions come up and it can almost paralyze us, you know. And so being able to have that support and, you know, that's one of the things I think certainly about hospice care and having that team support that can just help facilitate and give some ideas around those end of life conversations.
Well, I've been talking with Kathy Cromwell from Heinz Hospice. Thank you so much for being on the show.
Thank you, Kathy.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. After a hiatus of 19 months, the Fresno Philharmonic returns to live in-person concerts this weekend. KVPR's David Aus spoke with President and CEO Stephen Wilson and Music Director Ray Hatoda.
Stephen Wilson, great to have you with us today. Let's talk about the season coming up and what you've been doing to make all that happen.
Yeah, well, it's great to be with you, David. Yeah, this has been quite a journey. The last time that the Fresno Philharmonic performed before a live audience was February of 2020. Our planning for this season was somewhat different because at the time we were putting the season programming together, there were still obviously a lot of unknowns about exactly what the COVID-19 situation would be in the fall and even continuing on into the winter and spring. So kind of unusually for us, we developed a sort of two-part season. We have three fall concerts that are being held at the Paul Chagoyan Memorial Concert Hall out on the Clovis North Campus. That hall is smaller than our usual home, the Saroyan Theater. The Chagoyan Hall seats only 750 people and lends itself to presentations with a somewhat smaller orchestra ensemble, like a chamber orchestra sized ensemble. So we thought that both the combination of just having a smaller audience, we're doing two performances of each of those fall concerts to allow us to spread the audience out across the two houses, and then having, you know, again, a somewhat smaller orchestra was a way of at least thinking about being able to deal with whatever the COVID situation was. And this was, those plans were made before the Delta variant became a factor. And so now we're actually quite glad that we adopted that approach. We return to the Saroyan Theater starting in December for our annual Home for the Holidays concert. And then from January through May, we're doing a three concert series in the Saroyan Theater. And those have normal large orchestra ensembles doing bigger repertoire and everything. And so our hope was that the coronavirus situation would be better as the season went on. But at least this the start this coming weekend, the weekend of September 11th and 12th, you know, to let us kind of ease both our orchestra as well as the audience back to a comfort level with live performance. And then there are also other COVID-related procedures that we're implementing in order to, you know, create a safe environment both for the audience and for the orchestra.
So let's talk about that. What should audience members know who are planning to attend? What protocols are you going by?
Well, I think first and most important is that we're requiring all audience members to show proof of either COVID vaccination or of a negative COVID test that was taken within 72 hours of the concert date. Also, we are requiring, at least for now, for all audience members to remain masked while they're inside the venue. Those guidelines are similar to what the current state of state guidelines around indoor live performance are. Right now, the state is requiring proof of vaccination and masking for venues that are at least 1,000 seats. Chagoyan Hall seats 750. So it's under that. So not technically required, but we thought that was certainly close enough that it's
prudently in line. And
right.
And I know there are other smaller venues that are abiding by the same kinds of guidance.
We have very, very similar requirements, actually more stringent for the orchestra, the staff, the backstage crew, all of that. There is a vaccine requirement for everyone working on the performance. Also, too, we are implementing a testing protocol for musicians. And then all musicians except for wind and brass players will be masked on stage. So what the audience is experiencing is very similar to what all the performers and all the people working on the production will be experiencing. So our greatest hope is by the time of the downbeat for the concerts, everyone can kind of forget about COVID and then just relax and feel they're safe and feel it's good and just really, really focus on the music. That's really where we want to be.
You also have some other good news about this season and going forward that involves your music director.
Yes, this season marks the renewal of Ray Hotota's contract as music director of the Fresno Philharmonic. This is her fifth season with us, and so we've renewed her contract for an additional 4 years. I think we knew, and I think our audience knew right from the beginning that Ray was the best choice for us as a music director. I think she proved that doubly in this past year in terms of the adaptation to COVID. Ray just jumped in with both feet, doing recording of interviews, you know, figuring out all the aspects of producing digital concerts. I mean, it was really a delight working with her. She's so creative. She's so flexible. I can't think of a better music director to have in place through what we've been through in the past year. So we're all just absolutely thrilled that she's going to be with us for at least another 4 years.
I also got to speak with music director Ray Hotota and pianist Joyce Yang, the guest artist on this weekend's concerts. Here's a bit of our conversation.
Ray, what's it feel like?
We are all ready to make music and share our music with our audiences. And, you know, when you think about it, the audience is just as instrumental as the people on stage. you know, there's this wonderful energy that happens between the audience and the music that's happening on stage. And I have missed that. Our musicians have missed that. Joyce, how do you feel about this return to live in-person concerts?
There's nothing like it. And I am just really, really happy and excited for us all gathering and sharing that love of music again.
What pieces will audiences be hearing?
Well, we're so thrilled to have Joyce Yang perform Liszt's E-flat major concerto number one. And I think it's such an incredible piece in that it's so vibrant and exciting. And there's this wonderful dialogue that's happening between the soloist and the orchestra right away. There's drama and triumph.
Joyce Yang shares a bit more about the Liszt piano concerto number one.
A lot happens in very little time. There are so many twists and turns. It truly is this like extraordinary roller coaster. And this piece is very operatic. There's a lot of moments where the pianist is left alone to sort of sing an aria, you know, and there are moments where, you know, things fall out of time and Liszt gives the pianist the freedom to come out from the texture. And then we get right back to that pulsating, that very exciting, very shocking, very virtuosic place again, where we just reach the next chapter and then something completely different happens. So I think this piece really keeps me on my toes and also the audience. And it used to be in separate movements, but over 20 years of Liszt editing this piano concerto, it became one through composed experience. And it is in that way, I think, even more exciting because you don't get that that moment of rest where you turn the page and say, okay, next chapter. This is just completely like the window opens and then we jump out and we find ourselves in a totally new place. And there's so many scene changes that occur without any warning or foreshadowing.
Really, this whole program runs the human emotional gamut from the lyric piece by George Walker, and then we end with Mozart Symphony No. 41.
That was Fresno Philharmonic music director Ray Hotoda and a pianist Joyce Yang. I wish I had more time to visit with them. Fresno Philharmonic returns to live performances this weekend, Saturday, September 11th and Sunday, September 12th. For Valley Edition, I'm David Aus.
And finally, the Sequoia Parks Conservancy invites you to shift your gaze upwards this weekend as part of its annual Dark Sky Festival, which this year you can participate in from home. I talked with Katie Whiteman, one of the event's organizers, about what to expect during this weekend's virtual festival. Well, take us behind the decision to make the Dark Sky Festival a virtual event again this year.
Yeah, that was a difficult decision for us. It really comes down to just making sure that we made the best decision for everyone's safety. At the beginning of this year, we really didn't understand what the pandemic was going to be doing in the fall. And we just made the decision that we wanted to make the safest decision for everyone and create a platform and a space for everyone to safely be able to participate in the festival. And we decided that the virtual option was the best. And we hope that next year that we'll be able to welcome everybody in the parks. That's what we love to do. That's what we're really good at. And we will have that goal for next year. But this year, we just really focused on safety and wanted to create a safe and fun experience for everyone who would like to participate.
Well, tell us about a couple of the events or speakers that you are really excited about.
Yeah. Oh, I'm so excited about this whole festival. I think one of my favorite speakers who actually has been with us since the very beginning of the Dark Sky Festival is Terry Hines. And Terry has really been kind of our connection to NASA and the Jet Propulsion Laboratory and what's happening on Mars. Terry has been a part of more than 30 deep space missions, and he is so passionate about the Dark Sky Festival, and we love having him, and I'm really excited to just welcome him back and hear what's happening on Mars right now. Perseverance just landed in February, as well as InSight. And so we're just super excited to welcome Terry back and to get an update on what's happening on Mars. And this year, we're also going to welcome one of our National Park Service rangers, Lauren Hare. And this year's festival is, the theme of this festival is Discover Your Night. And we really want people to get out in their space around their homes and look up at the sky. And Lauren is going to teach people how to stargaze in their backyard. So that way people are learning the tools to go out and enjoy the night sky away from other people, and just do that in a safe way. And they don't necessarily have to come to the festival for that. They can do that right in their backyard. And so I'm really excited that Ranger Lauren will be with us and giving people those tools to enjoy the stars just from their backyard.
Well, where can people sign up and take a look at the schedule for the weekend?
Absolutely. Great question. So all of our schedules and everything is online on our website at www.sequoiaparksconservancy.org. And there is a button for the Dark Sky Festival, or people can just do a / Dark Sky Festival as well. And people will be able to interact with the schedule and sign up for the different talks by Terry and Lauren, or our virtual star party that's happening on Saturday night. But we also have online, we have our online platform where it really is about people's own discovery of the night sky. There's a big purple button that says start discovering. We want people to click that button and really start discovering their night and going through the platform and learning everything that they can. And we're really hoping that throughout the weekend that people also interact with us. We want people to send us photos and poems and pictures of things that they're learning and they're seeing. So it's going to be a great weekend. Everything that people will need is on the website, and it's free for everyone. There are no charges. All you got to do is for some of those talks or is sign up, but it's all free of charge. And really, we're hoping people from all ages will come out and come and enjoy this virtual Dark Sky Festival.
You know, I'm wondering what your thoughts are about how the pandemic might have perhaps contributed to a growing sense of interest in astronomy, you know, given the fact that all of us were stuck at home for so long.
Yeah, right. No, exactly. I've been thinking a lot about that question. And I think that people's curiosity and just, you know, being outside both during the day and at night has really come alive during the pandemic. We've seen that in the park where people have just kind of been craving the outdoors, and for being, you know, kind of inside for so long and kind of, you know, sheltered inside for everyone's safety, people have started to emerge and are really kind of seeking that connection outside. And I think going out at night in particular and looking up at the night sky, and that's the thing I love about the stars and about astronomy, is that, you know, no matter where you're at on the planet, you're going to be able to look up, and it's a thing that brings us all together. The stars brings us all together. And even here in the Northern Hemisphere, this is the same stars that we're all looking at. And so sometimes when we feel far apart, like we do here in the pandemic, the night sky really does bring us together. And I think that has really piqued people's curiosity and their interest in the night sky. So we're really excited to be able to host this virtual Dark Sky Festival just to foster some of that learning. And we really hope that people take the opportunity to interact with us during the weekends and just get out and discover their night around their homes.
I've been talking with Katie Whiteman with Sequoia Parks Conservancy about the Dark Sky Festival this weekend. It sounds like it's going to be a lot of fun. Katie, thank you so much for being on the show.
You're very welcome. Thank you so much for having me.
And that's today's Valley Edition. You can hear all this and more on our website, kvpr.org. You can also download the podcast and find us on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook. We've got an app. It's called KVPR. The show is produced by our news team, including Alice Daniel, Carrie Klein, Madi Bolaños, and Sarith Hawk. Technical support is from Don Weaver. I'm your host, Kathleen Schock. Thanks for listening.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, committed to a California where all low-income workers have the power to advance economically. Learn more at irvine.org. The California Endowment. Health happens when Californians value schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendowed.org. The California Healthcare Foundation, working to build a more effective, compassionate, and just healthcare system. On the web at chcf.org/health-equity.